So, into the bug.
So what I'm going to do tonight is a little complicated. I mean, it requires something of you and something of me, and I hope it will work. My original intention was to make this entirely an experiential session, and to give you some exercises and, you know, give you a chance at doing some first-person inquiry. And it seems to me that for some people who already do their own form of first-person inquiry, it would be interesting to try something different. And for some people who haven't had experience with it, it would be interesting to try something new. And that is still where I would like to focus quite a bit. But I realized in the course of the presentation, and I'll say, or in the course of the preparation or thinking about it, actually not so much in preparing this, because this is easy for me. I lead this kind of exercise all the time. But in the course of preparing for the conference, I realized that there were really some issues emerging for me that I wanted to have a chance to present. And so I want to do that tonight as well. And so I'll be going back and forth somewhat. And when we do the experiential exercise, the appropriate response from you, as far as I'm concerned, is to give feedback, response, discuss, ask questions, whatever, about your experience with the exercises or about the kind of underlying sense of what the exercises are about. And that's quite different from the appropriate response when I'm doing a presentation, when I'm just doing what everybody else is doing, and you can ask me the same kinds of questions or interrupt, or you know, we can take that in whatever direction it goes. So I think I'm just asking you to be a little sensitive to the distinction, I suppose. So the title of the talk is Into the Vague, and the presentation, I should say. And let's see if I can get it to work like a slideshow. Stick that in there somewhere. It'll work. And that comes from the famous quote by William James. It is the reinstatement of the vague to its proper place in our mental life, which I am so anxious to press on your attention. The definite images of our traditional psychology form but the very smallest part of our minds as they actually live. The significance, the value of the image is all in this halo or penumbra that surrounds and escorts it. James, as always, is a lovely writer. People often focus on this idea of the halo, but they don't talk so much about the vague. Well, I'm sure people have. But vague has sort of a negative connotation. You know, it's like, if you're not clear, you're vague. But I actually really want to suggest that there is something valuable about vagueness, and that is what my presentation part is mostly going to be about. Let me, before I really launch into that, give you another image. This is not a very beautiful image graphically, but it's very meaningful. I liked it so much back when I was starting the Center for Creative Inquiry that I thought I'd use it as the kind of logo, or, you know, but it's just not nice enough. People said, well, there has to be something on top of those pillars. What it is the frontispiece, the front of Bacon's Novum Organum. So really at the very beginning of modern science. And what it shows is the pillars of Hercules, which traditionally marked out the boundaries of the known world. And so these are ships sailing beyond the boundaries of the known world. And at the very bottom, there is a little quote in Latin, which I can't quite make out myself from here, and I won't try to pronounce, but translated, it says, many will pass through, and knowledge will grow. Mm. Actually, the word that's used is ciencia, science, and science will grow. But back in those days, the word ciencia had a much broader meaning, and I think this relates to something that Orban was saying. We know one way to do science, and there's one of the questions is, are there other ways to do science? If so, can we get a handle on them? And could we get anybody to agree that they were equally valid in certain spheres? That would be the kind of question. But it's a wonderful image for what it seems to me is possible for a first-person science. Many will pass through and knowledge will grow. Now, I'm going to give you 5 questions. And later on, after we've had a chance to do some practice, I will come back to those questions and I will reorder them, kind of shrink them down a little bit. These are questions that we've been discussing in various ways. Maybe not so much the first one, which is the one that is the inspiration for this presentation.
We haven't talked about that, I think, explicitly.
Okay. Is the vague the enemy of science? And I put in parentheses there the unknown, because we did talk about the unknown, wondering whether the vague and the unknown were the same thing. I'm just leaving that open right now. So is the vague the enemy of science? And the reason that seems like an answer that one might answer yes, is because there's a lot of discussion that came up in Raban's talk that science is meant to be rigorous. The idea is that science is rigorous in its investigation of the real world, and it seems as though the vague is perhaps the enemy of that kind of rigor. Now, I want to question that, and we will see why, I hope. And the second is in a way, a reformulation of that. Should our aim be to gain precision regarding the workings of consciousness? Precision is really another word for rigor, as far as I'm concerned. Or is the truth out there? And what I mean by out there is James's vague, right? Out beyond the specific things that we can identify, out beyond the contents of our consciousness, if we are willing to drop our commitment to getting clear about what's going on and enter the vague, is that where we will find something true about our own consciousness? Is that where we will learn to be conscious differently? So those two questions are pretty much reformulations of each other, two formulations of one another. Is bracketing the presupposed the answer? And I could have said that in so many different ways, but that's one of the formulations that's been used here. I think it comes up most clearly in Russ's work, where he says, you know, it's really important for him and for his subjects to bracket their understanding of what's going on, their presuppositions, their explanation of what's going on, their reasons, their formulations, and of course in phenomenology, bracketing the epoche is very much at the heart of things. And I think there is a sense in which, and I'm giving you kind of my very general answers, and then we'll look at it more. I think there is a sense in which bracketing the presupposed is very, I don't know if it's the answer, but it's very important. But it may not mean exactly what people sometimes think that it means. So I want to look at that. And if so, what methods are available for doing so, that we'll be looking at. And then a question that Russ answered with a very decisive no in I think in what he posted on the website, but I'm not sure right now, is armchair introspection a valid approach? And that actually leads me to my acknowledgments. I put that there as a reminder to myself in a way. The reason that I started thinking about this as a presentation to make, and the reason that I really started to think that there was something that I could contribute to this group in a kind of a systematic way, is that in preparation for the conference, I focused especially on the two articles by Russ and Claire in Phenomenology and Cognitive Science. I think it's in the most recent issue, right? And they both have articles there laying out the kind of work they do. And as I went through those, I just realized, you know, I began to decide that there was something I had to contribute to that discussion that I really wanted to share. So I really want to acknowledge your inspiration for leading me in that direction. And specifically, and we'll have a chance to look at this, I realized that one of the things that I do, in addition to organizing conferences like this, and occasionally writing papers and so on, is I teach. In particular, I teach this method, I shouldn't call it a method, this approach based on a series of books that Tartan Tulku has written called Time, Space, and Knowledge. The first book was called Time, Space, and Knowledge. And the others in the series have other names, but so we generally refer to it just as Time, Space, and Knowledge, or TSK. Tartang Tulku, who's the Lama who founded all of this. And he's made it very clear in those books that they are not Buddhist. They are something that he thinks might be helpful for the Western mind, essentially. And the heart of those books, I think, is a form of inquiry. And it's very experientially based, although there's quite a bit of theory in it, too. And we'll talk about the relationship between those two things as we go along. So I realized that if I looked at it from a slightly different perspective, and one of the interesting things was that both Russ and Claire, who are the people who so far have been saying, okay, we have a methodology, we have an approach, here's what we do, are doing second-person methodology. Right? Not first-person in a pure sense, right? They're not saying, they're not doing armchair introspection, certainly. They're saying we're interviewing subjects. And I realized that looking from a different, slightly different perspective than I usually do, the work that I do in teaching these classes is not so dissimilar. It's not as systematic at all. It's not as rigorous at all. But I encourage people to do certain kinds of practices and to do some reading, and we discuss them. And the idea is to give them ways to learn more about what it means to be conscious. We don't use the word conscious in TSK so much, but learn more about the mind, learn more about being, to use Matthew's phrase.
What is armchair introspection in this terminology? Do you mean individually looking inside yourself?
Yeah, the idea is somebody sitting in his study and looking inward and saying, this is the way consciousness works, this is the way the mind works, I have all the data I need just by looking at my own experience.
That, of course, isn't the... that's not an exact contrast with second person, where you're talking to others in a rigorous way or whatever. But because auto introspection, if you like, or auto inquiry, doesn't have to be done in an armchair, because it can be done in any, in many different situations.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I think armchair introspection is armchair introspection for me is a word like navel gazing. It's sort of a derogatory way of talking about a particular approach.
Yeah, I question how far does it go? I mean, would William James's experiments with introspection be considered armchair introspection, or would Krishnamurti's journeys with introspection, or Tartang Tulku's? If Russ is the one who's majority stand on that, how far would he apply that?
Well, I think the answer that I want you to, or the way I want you to approach that question, is to do some of these exercises and then see if they're, if there's anything interesting that comes of them. And I'd be perfectly willing to call them armchair introspection for starters.
There's a Buddhist scholar, I'm sure you'll recognize, I don't know who it is, said, I spent all day meditating and would have done better to learn. I stood on tiptoe to get a better view and would have done better to climb a hill.
No, I don't know that phrase. I thought it was Zen, but anyway. Okay, so these are five questions. We will return to them later, as I said, in a somewhat different form, but it gives you an idea of the kinds of things I'm going to be looking at. Now, here are three exercises. This is what we're going to be doing. And we will not do the exercises 1, 2, 3. We will do an exercise and talk about it. And then at least in a couple of cases, I will want to expand on that and actually introduce some material from a course that I've been teaching online. We'll get to that, so I don't have to go into it right now. These are the three exercises that we're going to do: expanding and condensing, embodiment of knowledge, and space between thoughts. And these are the actual names that are given to the exercises. So we will start right in, I believe, with expanding and condensing. So I'm taking these instructions, I've reworded them a little bit, but I'm taking them from the actual books. Actually, I'm taking the second and third from the book Time, Space, and Knowledge. This exercise although it's been used for years by people who are doing that kind of inquiry, was never written down until I wrote it down in a book that I wrote, came out last year, called When It Rains, Does Space Get Wet? Which is, yeah, it's actually not When It Rains, Does Space Get Wet? Yeah. Which is, the reason I chose that title is not mine, it's from one of the books, it's a quote from one of the books, is that it in itself points towards the kind of inquiry that one might do. I will go through this and see if you have any questions, and then we will do it, and because I have given myself kind of a full agenda, we'll probably only do it for about 10 minutes, and I'll say something about that length of time. When we've gone through this instruction. So, settle into your experience. What does that mean? That means whatever is going on for you. Right? Whatever is going on for you, it's meant to be as open-ended as the kind of thing that Russ does. You know, what was going on at the moment of the beep? So you start off with what's going on right now. Now, if you want to investigate some specific kind of experience, that's all right. You know, if you decide, well, okay, expanding and condensing. I think I'd like to expand thoughts. You know, so you start with that. Or I'd like to expand physical sensations. You work with that. You can make those decisions. That's fine. It did occur to me, especially as Susan was giving her presentation, that if you have a particular kind of theoretical stance, some take you have on how consciousness might operate or some aspect of consciousness, and you would like to explore that in a first-person way by expanding and condensing or condensing, that's fine too. So it really is up to you. Yes?
I don't really understand what you mean by expand.
Well, okay, let's talk about that. Or let's go through the instructions and see if that helps. And then we can talk about it. Settle into your experience and then begin to expand or condense it. Keep in mind that experience is made up of many aspects. Thoughts, sensations, feelings, identifications, judgments, perceptions, the relations among these elements and other features that may be too subtle to name. So we're moving toward the vague, right? But you can start with things that are pretty, you can stay completely with things that are pretty definite. You can expand or condense any one of these or the whole of your experience. For instance, you could expand the sense of distance that separates you from an object in front of you. Or you could condense your sense of self. You could expand the sensation in your shoulder, or condense the feeling, should say, of time passing, or a vague feeling of anxiety, if that's what you happen to be feeling. You could try to make up a feeling of anxiety and expand that, but, you know, aware that it's a made-up feeling. Notice that the exercise calls for you to condense rather than contract. Most people try to contract. And expanding is not so difficult, right? If you say, I'm going to expand, you may find you can't do this at all. That's all right. But most people, if you say, okay, there's a sensation in my shoulder, I'm going to expand that feeling. You have a sense of that. You would have a sense of that, probably. You might find it more difficult to say, there's a sensation in my shoulder, I'm going to condense it. So the clue here is that it's not the same as contracting it. It's not the same as making it smaller. Condensing has to do with making it more dense. It may grow smaller in the course of doing that.
I'm a little bit unclear as to what you mean by either expand or condense. I mean, if you're using your example of the pain in the shoulder, do you mean by expanding it, something as mundane as making it grow, so it's not just in your shoulder, but over your arm, and, you know.
That would be one way to do it. Did anybody else have an immediate thought about how one might expand a pain that's different from that?
You've got to turn it into something else than pain.
Mm-hmm. Turn it into something else than pain.
Okay. Expand it out into the world.
Okay. So,
so you mean do something to it which fits the description, expand, but you can
which,
decide.
It, that's right. Which in your sense of expanding fits.
You're not saying, there is something called expand, which I want you to do in relation to your saying, find something for some meaning of expand, do that thing in relation to
it. Yeah, and okay. You know, part of the quality here, if you say, we've been talking about rigorous ways of exploring first-person experience, and I'm talking about more vague ways. This is a vague instruction, in the sense that I'm not telling you what to do beyond suggesting an overall approach, which is expanding or condensing.
Why are you asking us to do it, Jack?
As a way of loosening up your sense of what your experience is. That's basically it. Expanding it, it's a little bit like, let's say you have a tight muscle and you massage it. Right? This is a kind of a massage experience. The other thing I might mention is people usually find it easier to expand than condense. And if you want to spend most of your time expanding, you can.
Sorry, can I express another worry?
Sure.
Because in the case of saying, I want you to condense rather than contract, mm-hmm. that seems to somewhat go against what you just said, because I can't see, you know, mm-hmm. the same thing goes with condense as goes for expand. Then you want us to find a meaning to mm-hmm. condense, which will enable us to then do that thing mm-hmm. in relation to our experience. Mm-hmm. But I don't see how you can do that without, you know, without it being very probable that the word contract will also apply to that same thing.
That might be the case. That's fine.
But then why say do condense rather than contract?
Because contract is a limitation on the possibilities. Condense is meant to open it up.
But
more.
That could be something that you could do. I mean, so condense.
You could contract. I mean, maybe the way you condense something is by contracting it. That's fine.
His exercise doesn't tell you to condense rather than contract. It says that the exercise says uses the word condense rather than contract. But that doesn't mean that you can't contract.
Instead of doing it, right? So let's try doing it.
Jack, is the relationship between expanding and condensing an either or relationship?
No, you could both expand and condense at the same time. That's, most people don't feel so comfortable doing that in the beginning, but if you think that would be sort of a neat trick, give it a try. Yeah. Yes. Of course. And you know, I mean, there's so many possibilities, and doing it will be more helpful than my saying things. But you could just go with the flow of whatever your experience is, and then there'd probably be a lot of things that you work with. Or you could say, I'm going to try working with this feeling and just keep working with it, or, you know, there's and many other possibilities.
And the point is that we should discover something new we didn't know about our experience.
I hate to say there's a point, but let's say that there's the idea of working with your experience in an unusual way may lead to something interesting. And this is an unusual way, as far as, you know, people don't generally do this for most things. So, expanding and condensing, we'll do it about 10 minutes, which is about how long I would normally do it with a group of people who didn't have experience. So this will work just fine. The later exercises, we may expand a little. We'll probably condense a little. So, we'll do it for about 10 minutes, okay? You can do it with your eyes open or closed. If you feel like it, you can walk around. There are no restrictions here.
Are we going to talk about it
afterwards? Afterwards, we will talk. I guess, well, there is one restriction. I'd rather you didn't talk while we're doing the exercise.
You're
Okay, let's stop there. It was more like 8 minutes, but I just sounded, it just seemed like that might be good to stop. So, I'd like to hear from you. Anything you noticed about the experience that you seem that is interesting enough to report on? Or anything else you'd like to say?
Well, I think what I noticed was that I found myself pulling myself back to where I began. It seemed to be as I contracted, I thought, go any further that way, and I'm going to go to sleep, or going to lose it.
Hmm.
As I expanded it, I thought, this is uncomfortable, you know, not, actually, it's not true to life. And so I was brought back again to the sort of golden mean of the dream, which is where it started. And some way I thought, well, this isn't surprising. Surely I will have settled on the optimal level of expansion or contraction to begin with, and any deviation it might be interesting, but it's not going to be satisfactory.
Okay.
That's interesting. So you saw expansion and contraction as going from both deviating from the normal.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, so I looked around the room and I saw people apparently out of it. Everyone, all but two, had their eyes closed. I thought, you know, they're moving away from actually a normal human presence in the world.
Well, how about that? Do people feel they were moving away from an optimum human presence? Is it optimum? Is that fair?
An optimum human presence.
Presence, yeah.
Yes.
Human it's presence in the world. It's
okay, human presence in the world.
Yeah, I think that I found the same. That when I did many contents, some of which were perceptual, and I was uncomfortable with that because I felt that you know, that might lead me to be more prone to hallucinate larger distances or smaller distances. So I stopped doing that, and I did that on images rather than on actual perceptions.
I don't think we will do this a second time because there's a lot of ground I want to cover, but. One way to modify the instruction based on the kinds of things you're saying is you might want to be ready to expand and contract on a kind of meta level. If you have a reaction like this would make me uncomfortable, to either expand or condense that reaction.
So second order expansion. Mm-hmm.
Second order expansion or condensing. Yeah.
Well, I noticed a distinction between imagining that I'm expanding or contracting something, condensing something, versus actually doing that with some sort of state or object.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, an unhappy coincidence. I actually have, for the past two or three weeks, had 3 weeks, called a serious enough pain here to mm-hmm. cause me to seek help. And I'm sort of managing it. But your choice of example was just funny.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, okay, well, now I'll try and follow what Jack is saying. And the phenomenology of it has been extraordinarily rich. The pain starts here and goes down here. And there's a candidate muscle, whatever's happened. And the pain is enough to stop me sleeping at night, and you know, something I really don't want, but can't continue really. And I thought, okay, well, I'll try and expand and contract and see what happens. And I used Claire's example of somehow feeling some space in the fabric. I thought, okay, well, I'll have a roughly muscle-shaped, lozenge-shaped space out there. I'll try and sort of blow up that muscle that's giving me, if that is the problem, into that shape, and perhaps do it with my breath, so time it with the breathing. And I noticed that it's a bit like blowing up a balloon. As I was blowing it up, the pain went away. But when it reached the maximum expansion, the pain came back. And then I tried that a bit, and it was very consistent. And then I found myself thinking, is this you just telling yourself a story? Or, I couldn't
that I think too much more about it. So then I thought I'll try and condense it, and I thought that discussion about contract and condense was quite interesting, because contract, in terms of muscle, is rather different. And I thought if he told me contract, I would have been sitting here with my arm sort of twitching up like that. But condense it was rather different and difficult. And I stopped that pretty quickly because the pain was unpleasant.
So the question tense is the word is condensed.
Yes.
Rather than, you know, kind of making it sort of just fold into itself and maybe disappear.
That's right.
Up itself, sort of thing.
Yeah.
into it.
That's exactly it. Condensed and therefore intensified. Mm. It's rather as if you took some large, low key, well, think of it in terms of thermodynamics. There's a large volume of gas which is warm, and you compress it into a tiny area. It's hot, it's unpleasant, and I stopped that straight away.
Okay.
So there's a very rich phenomenology there, which I hadn't expected.
I just want to say that I don't feel that we are dealing with the vague, because John says very precise things about the experience.
It is the vague, in the sense that I was suggesting, in that he's given us some words, and we're finding our own ways of, well, the words are vague in the sense that there is no, you know, it's not like, you know, carry all the cups into the kitchen, you know, which is precise enough for us to be pretty clear what the instruction is. He was telling us something where the instruction was really very unclear and vague in that sense, and we were actually, you know, making our own decision or coming to some understanding ourselves of how to interpret those instructions. So in that sense, it was about convening, I think.
14 out of 16 of us chose to close our eyes to cut out the initial experience, which probably dominated us at the time I was talking to, which is a visual presence in the light of this room, in order to undertake something which I think is probably easier, which is to deal with somatic sensation of the kind John's talking about, where these instructions make sense. I found they made very little sense in terms of physical phenomenology.
Okay, Susan? And then Russ, and then we'll move on.
I think I found the instructions vague, but in some ways that was helpful, but I also think that I think propositionally a lot, and I closed my eyes, and because I thought this was going to be the easiest way to do it, and I thought of Michael Drayton's sonnet, since there's no help, come let us kiss and part, and then I started to expand that. Mm-hmm. And then I went round a couple of times, and then I thought, this isn't the game, this isn't what I'm meant to be doing, because all I'm doing is going in a loop, and I'm not expanding, I'm not trying to lengthen the sentences, and then I thought, all I'm doing is propositional, and that's not really what you want us to do, and it's just exactly what Claire was just saying was a bit wrong with, because there's a clarity to that, which isn't a good thing. It's not being... So then I opened my eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started moving the distance between me and the light.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that easier somatically.
Okay.
And that was easy because I could do that expanding and contracting.
Let me say about right and wrong, doesn't count, doesn't work that way.
Okay,
you know, whatever your experience is, and actually what you're describing, you know, it would never have occurred to me to try to, expand a line in a sonnet by making, was it visual? This is the sort of clarifying question that Russ and Claire would ask, but were you doing that visually? Were the letters getting bigger?
No, I was lengthening the words as I heard them in my head.
So the sound of the word actually got bigger?
Yeah.
What was the line?
Now go through, because I've since the middle comes as cousin part, and I've done and I am glad, nay, glad with all my heart, that thus so keenly I myself can free. And it's so I was doing this very, very slowly.
Then. Okay. And I want to say the same thing about John's experience. The fact that it was precise is, you know, I'm not saying your experience has to stay vague. I'm saying that whatever your experience is, whether it be vague or precise, there is a way to work with it. And exactly how one would work with it stays vague. Precision is no, we'll try to say anything about that. Okay, Russ, and then we'll move on.
Well, you talked about it a little bit, but I wanted to point out that I thought that Steve and Claire were missing each other's point, it seemed to me, or Steve was a third point or something. James's quote that started this was that experience was made.
Mm-hmm.
And Claire's point was that the experience that we were reporting here was not at all vague. Mm-hmm. It was quite clearly experience. Mm-hmm. And you interpreted the instructions as being vague, which is an entirely different thing, which is not what James was talking about and not what Claire was talking about.
Okay, I must say, I wasn't bearing the James quote in mind. I was just saying there was, that it had a relation to the title of the evening.
And of course, for people like Claire and me who have a method that tries to get at experience, it's important to observe that experience is not vague much of the time.
I think that's, yeah, you're right about that. What people will report is usually quite precise.
But James's sense of vague was too subtle to name.
Yeah, and that is something, you know, none of the reports we've heard so far go in that direction, but they could. Of the examples that are in here, that are given here, the one that goes the most in that direction, I think, is the one that says, expanding the sense of distance that separates you, which is something Susan tried to do. Not because that's vague, really. It's pretty clear, but the feeling tone, or however you would want to describe that, the quality of distance is not something that we usually focus on. It's more, that would be something that might count as the halo or penumbra of an experience, right?
I think what I did when I was, you know, finding something to do which counted as expanding, and what I was doing in trying to condense, I ended up doing both times things that were vague.
Hmm.
I was an eyes open person, and I was just looking at the wall, and I did actually give myself a task that was actually quite succinct. And it was based on an observation made by Alvin Noe and Kevin O'Regan, which is that you might think the wall's got a single colour, but when you start looking at it, and you expand your awareness of the wall, which isn't quite what they said, you discover it's all variegated. Mm-hmm. So I started, you know, trying to see how many variations there were to the apparently, you know, at first sight monolithic colour of the wall, and and that was. Actually, but then the boundaries of that activity got increasingly vague as I added various other things. And then, but when I tried to condense, I found it actually vague in a different sense, so that I couldn't actually do anything very clear. I was just searching around for something to do under that title.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, as you predicted, it was harder.
Okay. So, Walt, one last thing, and then we'll move on.
While you were describing the exercise, I was kind of running through possibilities. Something you might encourage about what sort of things might be salient for me that I might want to focus on.
Mm-hmm.
And I never got through with that. I just kind of ran through various things about what had been going on, you know, in the last few days of my life. And then just at the point where you said to start, I realized that I was aware of my stomach. I wouldn't say exactly in the sense of the way you're supposed to do it when you're meditating, just more that it was there it was, and it's full of curried vegetables and ice cream and red wine. It felt pretty good. I guess I made a decision at some point. I sort of ran through various things that kind of came up in my consciousness, including I think the last conversation I had before we came here, which was sitting at the dinner table with John, and we just had a little exchange about how it feels to be growing older.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was kind of there.
So did you expand did you expand or condense that conversation?
No, the thing I decided to focus on was kind of the gestalt of all those things that had been floating around, just sort of putting together. Okay. You know, this beautiful place that we're in, and the things that I'm kind of dealing with in my life and mm-hmm. what I had for dinner and
okay.
things like that that are pretty much here and now. And that was very interesting, kind of
okay.
putting this moment together and knowing that because I did that, I will always remember this evening here in this mm-hmm. place and mm-hmm. in this awareness of this mm-hmm. time and space. And then there was one other thing, which is that I kind of, the expansion part, I just kind of tried to expand that out into time and space and kind of think about where this thing is and sort of the scope of evolution and everything. And I zapped back to another thing that John had said during his presentation about this image of, I forget exactly how you put it, but it was sort of in the midst of the primordial chaos that something says, I want to know, you know, mm-hmm. that's mm-hmm. sort of the seed of yeah. all being and evolution.
Okay.
And I just kind of played with that being what's present here in all of us as we do this thing. That's yeah. about as far as I got before
okay.
I ate in this breath.
Okay. Okay, let's move on. To the second exercise. We're going to do this a little bit different. It's a very different exercise. It's for those of you who do meditation, it has more the flavor of a meditation exercise, but you don't have to do it in any particular way. Let's go through the instructions.
You have to have your eyes shut for this.
No. Nothing. You don't have to do anything. There is an instruction here to keep your back straight. If you really don't want to, you don't have to. but it is a good idea for this kind of exercise. Relaxed, absolutely relaxed, not rigid at all, but straight. Sit in a relaxed way with your back straight. Visualize an intensely alive, gentle energy. And you may wonder how you can visualize a gentle energy. Just see what happens if you try. Or an intensely alive energy, for that matter. Visualize an intensely alive, gentle energy that you notice first at the base of your skull. Let this energy flow down the length of your spine and allow it to curve forward and upward inside your body, becoming warmer and more alive. When it reaches the point above and between your eyes, let it flow back again to the base of the skull and let it proceed downward again and repeat. It is more important to feel the energy than to see it. But some people feel like if it's energy, it must have a light component to it. If you find the visualization helpful or want to experiment, let the energy be a radiant blue. So it doesn't have to be blue, it doesn't have to be any color at all. It could be warmth, it could be any form of energy. But it's going to be a circulation of energy down your spine and back up the front. Okay, that's the basic exercise. We'll do this one a little bit differently. We'll do it for just a few minutes, and then maybe I'll see if people have questions about it, but then I'll give you some additional instructions. Okay, so we'll just do it for about 3 minutes. Cool. And don't worry, by the way, if you can't do it. Just see what happens. Okay. Maybe let's not have any comments right now. Let's just go on to the next phase of this. Refining the instructions. So, if you feel you didn't get very far with that and want to just continue again, we're going to do it for another 3 minutes, that's fine. If you would like to try to explore it in a different dimension, here are some suggestions. What happens if you focus primarily on, you can take your pick, the quality or feel of the energy, the color of the light, if in fact there was a light component, the feeling of flow, which is different from the feeling of the energy. Right? It's maybe a little bit hard to separate. And then, if there is any sense of this, the knowingness that the energy or light embodies. And just let yourself bear in mind that light is a metaphor for knowledge and see if that takes you any place interesting, if you want to explore that. You've got a lot of options here. And then, there's still more. We're doing it for such a short time that this is, you know, total overkill in terms of directions. But what happens if you try combining some or all of these elements, if you want to experiment with that? And then finally, if you keep the focus on the flow of energy, light, etc., what is the effect on the field in which the exercise takes place, on the feel of the field? I'm not going to try to define those words now. I may say a little bit about them later. So if they don't mean anything to you, don't worry about it right now. These were some instructions I gave to an online class I'm doing in TSK, and those terms have meaning within the context of the time-space knowledge vision. But you don't have to worry about them. So we'll do it again for about 3 minutes. Either go back to the original exercise, or if you like, experiment with any one of these things, or all. Okay? You okay? So we'll take some time for discussion. Anything you noticed or found interesting? Anything about the phenomenology of it? I think that's a nice way to put it for this group.
I find the light wouldn't move on its own. And then it transformed itself into a snake, which wriggled down my back and had a life of its own and went round in circles. But it was, so it became
spiraling.
Yeah, an independent density. It had its own energy. But until it became animate like that, it didn't work for me.
Was there a feeling to that energy? I mean, it was the snake's energy, so you didn't feel it, or did you feel it?
I felt it, but it felt very much independent to me. I mean, there was something else inhabiting me.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of feeling was it?
I felt it was kind of host to a rather benign parasite.
Mm-hmm. Is that benign?
Alien
mode. What do you mean when you say it was benign?
Maybe you'd like me to answer that for you. Yeah, I have no idea because it's your experience. <laughs> The name? I mean, we did have my interests. Felt good. Felt good. Okay. So I was grateful for this. So. Okay, felt good. Okay.
Anybody else? Yeah.
Again, the distinction between imagining it versus doing it, and the other thing being the exercise of relocating the point of attention along that route, and the challenge of doing that.
Now, when you say the distinction between imagining it and doing it, were you imagining it or doing it, or did you switch back and forth, or what?
I was trying to do it and not imagine that I was doing it.
Actually, you know, imagining doing it is not a bad way to start. If you can't do it, you can imagine doing it. But there is a difference.
Yeah, I see that there's a... Imagining doing it, you're creating a representation of doing it rather than doing it.
So when you say a representation, so this was this your experience? You kind of had a picture of yourself and the energy in that image was moving?
No, I was feeling... You mean what I was really doing?
Yeah, what were you really doing?
I was feeling my center of attention moving... That route that you expressed.
So you had a clear sense of the center of attention moving?
Yeah.
Not so much an energy, but there was an attention, a focus for your attention, and it took that route.
I was sort of following the energy that way.
So there was a sense of energy that you were following?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm actually being a little more precise in my question than I usually am, I'm sure because of the influence of, well, maybe more Russ than Claire, but it's good. Okay, anybody else? One more.
I couldn't get any light. I have no idea, and I think you're absolutely lucky, because I would like to have this kind of experience.
That snake?
So I don't know if that snake or
what. Right, not his snake. Right. Your own snake, your very own snake.
My own snake. Not somebody else's second-hand snake. So I used a word. I used the word size, and I forced that down my spine.
Well, the Y is very nice. I can see that.
It seemed like it was hot and searing. And,
really?
Yeah.
The word was.
Yeah, but then I couldn't get it to do anything when it got to the bottom.
It got stuck. Okay.
So then I gave up.
That's very interesting.
Scythe.
You know, did you have a sense of how scythe popped into your mind, or is that what happened?
Yeah,
did it pop?
It came from the beginning of the summit. Since.
Oh, so
and
you're...
Since wasn't strong enough. Since wouldn't go down anything.
So you made a decision, you said, I need a stronger word.
I need a stronger word.
And
besides,
Interesting. Okay, well, what I want to do now is I want to break out of the experiential mode for a moment, for a few moments, and stay related. This is a lot of text, I'm sorry, but... I thought it might be interesting for you to see how someone in the online program described his experience with this exercise. There's a fellow named David. That's his real name, I suppose. You know, you're supposed to disguise names, but you have no idea who he is. Neither do I, actually. I've never met him. He's on the East Coast somewhere. But I've seen a picture of him. But he's very articulate. I chose him because He's just done a really nice job of articulating his experience ever since the program began. And I know that he's been studying TSK for several years. He and a friend get together and do practices. But I didn't have contact with him previously. So he got basically the same instructions you just got. Normally, we would encourage people to do the exercise longer, say 20 minutes, roughly, maybe longer than that. I've been using this supplemental exercise. It is in the program. It's not exactly supplemental. It's one that I recommend to people to go back to if they're having trouble with other exercises. I've been using this supplemental exercise since the class began as a meditative warm-up and for its centering quality. Working with this exercise, my usual visual orientation is reoriented to a feeling focus. This releases a lot of the presupposed and mostly unnoticed limits and qualifiers that go with a visual orientation. For instance, subject-object dichotomies seem less obvious, as does the distance I usually assume in order to distinguish one from the other. The alternative focus on feeling is more global and immediate and less myopically fascinated with specific things and considerations about them. Now, I'll stop there for a moment and just say that if I think about the kind of reports that Russ wants to get, this is just full of theoretical stuff and explanations, and it's really quite, in that sense, certainly, it's not rigorous. That is, it doesn't have a rigorous focus on experience. On the other hand, and what I want to suggest to you is that it seems to me that he's observing some interesting things. Maybe he's got entirely the wrong idea. I don't care, really. But he's observing some interesting things. So then he goes on, and I'll talk now a little about feel of the field. From a feel of the field perspective, and knowing knowingness as light, these are kind of TSK talk type things, at first I looked to the colors of my internal experience. Let me just say something about feel of the field. There was a phrase, or a couple of phrases, people used this afternoon, I think Susan used, that I thought, kind of like feel of the field. Let's see if I can find them. No, I can't at the moment, but one of Merleau Ponty's phrases, the arc, something about the arc of the intention, that sounded sort of similar, and there was another one that came up. The basic idea here, I like the term feel the field a lot. We were talking about, how could one find appropriate kinds of language, and I think it's a great example of a phrase that is very simple, kind of immediately, and it's pretty obvious what you might be talking about. The basic idea here is that whenever you're having experience, it's occurring within a field of experience, and that has a kind of spatial dimension, but it doesn't have to be physical space. It's just the field of what's going on for you in that moment. And so part of what's available to you is the feel of the field. It's a little bit like what Walt maybe was talking about when he said the gestalt. From a feel of the field perspective and knowing knowingness as light, I won't comment on that. At first I looked to the colors of my internal experience. Experientially, the brightest and fullest light was when I was fully present to appearance. Now, how did he know that he was fully present? Well, I don't know. Maybe he wasn't, but that was his experience. The brightest and fullest light was when I was fully present to appearance, and more dim, the narrower my focus became, such as coming out. It's also a TSK term, to myopic self-pursuits and concerns, my own personal dimmer switch of knowing. Now, seen in this light, maybe color could have additional meaning. Here he's going to go off just into total speculation. You may not find this interesting at all. Maybe color could have additional meaning. A palette of sorts, consisting of a rainbow of nested fields of sound, smell, taste, touch, sight, all suspended within a translucent canvas of illumined knowing space. I am free to mix fields, derive blended flavors and tones, touch with memories, to envision, and to pose. Seen in this way, maybe light is doing the painting, and time is coloring. Yeah, I thought it was quite nice.
colorless green ideas, whatever. This sounds like a total junk, Jack, to be quite honest.
This sounds like a drunk?
junk.
Oh, okay.
Well, you know, it's verbiage, which actually I doubt that it has any reference at all, except he's making it up as he goes along.
But I think that's unfair because it may have, you can't say that.
Well,
you can't, I think that's a very unempathetic judgment.
So when you make that?
Every now and again, my jumping in there,
right.
I get random associations with the colourless green ideas sleep furiously. Sometimes they're poetic and sometimes they're quite fun to read. And Jack has clearly selected something which he thinks will find some meaning in a kind of Rorschach test. But I doubt that it's anything other than that. This is a pink ball.
So was your snake total junk?
It might be.
When you're the one who would know the answer, was it or not?
But it's not.
No, it was to me. That was a very specific image, and this is full of contradictions, paradoxes, meaningless connections and so on.
Right, and I'm totally in agreement with that. So I think I would be probably on your side if there's probably a lot of junk in there. But I also wanted to apologize a little bit back to you for what I said 5 minutes ago, which was that I should answer about your snake, and I was having fun at your expense about that. But I should be able to have a third-person view of what your first-person expense was.
Oh, I didn't understand quite what you meant.
And I was looking at you quite carefully and couldn't see any snakes.
Russ, have you ever gotten anything like this?
I've frequently got like that, and I would say that's not the kind of thing that I'm looking for. I'd like you to describe what's going on at the moment on the beat.
Sure.
That's not
fair because your beat methodology is fixed at a particular point.
Right. So
whereas this person is describing an ongoing experience and trying to give a general aperçu of a like a bird's eye view of some things that he's been discovering.
And there is so much room
doing this exercise.
There's so much room for the possibility of insertion of TSK jargony stuff. I don't know anything about it.
Yeah.
So
there's
so much room for that.
I have a totally unsupportable, probably unfair and wrong impression that this guy is putting up a bunch of stuff that was not what he was experiencing.
So you guys are saying it's vague? This is something guilty until proved innocent.
So let's let my pay speakers. Yeah.
Thank you.
I think that you are again trying to have this clean and untainted experience. I mean, there might be a loop between experience and then expression of experience, and then this expression changes the experience and so on. And I think that this guy was doing something like that. I mean, he was experiencing something, and then as he was trying to express it, it changed what he experienced. Mm-hmm. And I think we should look at the whole circle and not just at one point of his.
Mm-hmm. So let me comment on this just a little bit, how I react to it. There are certain things in here that I think are TSK talk, and we're always kind of, I'm always a little nervous about that, when somebody's trying to shape their experience in a way that conforms with what we've been reading or studying. That said, I don't care whether this is an accurate description of what was going on for him. I do care what kind of, what kind of insight he may have had into his experience. Whether this language is accurate to it or not, my impression on reading this is that there was something going on for him that was interesting enough that he was probably learning from it. That's basically it. Yeah.
And I would like to clarify what I thought, what I meant by sort of agreeing to the junk part. I did not mean to imply that I thought that what he did was not useful,
mm-hmm.
or that he wasn't in some impressionistic way describing it. What I thought was that there was probably quite a bit of junk in there, and it's not, I don't think, at all guilty until proven innocent, because I think the method is a guilty method. If the goal is to get an accurate description of what is going on with somebody, I don't think you can ask for a long period of time.
If that's the goal.
If that is the goal, I'm totally on that side. So I'm trying to define what I mean by junk. If that is the goal, then I would say this. Yeah.
So what do you say about Proust?
But that's not trying to get Proust.
It's not trying to get... I mean, oh, I'm sorry, my understanding of Proust has just been blown. I mean, the Madeleine case and all that. I mean, you know, I thought that was just what he was doing.
That could all
have
been in a moment as well, if you condense it.
Okay.
The Madeleine case is so articulate. I mean,
yes.
Nobody misses the meaning of that, and we all recognize it.
There was a moment, you could say, if the beef had gone off when he put the cake in his mouth, and that goes away, then, you know, wow, yeah. But he was talking about, that was a representative of a series of experiences, and it was expanded and generalized in all sorts
but
of ways.
A way
and it was one of a whole you know, it was just a the most famous of a whole
single, it could be a moment.
Okay. Wait, I want to stop this because, just for my own purposes, because I want to go on. I have other things I want to deal with. So, you know, probably more than I'll be able to, but we will see. So, we're not going to go on to a third exercise, okay?
And we're getting into introspection wars.
The third exercise is, again, actually an exercise that you find in meditative traditions. The space between thoughts is quite simple, really. As you observe your thoughts passing, watch very sensitively for the moment when one thought fades and another arises. The transition is very quick and subtle, but involves the momentary availability of a space that you can contact and even expand. So we're going to do this for just a few minutes, and it may well be that you have no experience of this. Even if you don't, it can be very interesting just to try to look at the point when one thought comes to an end and the next starts. I mean, that presumably has to happen, right? There has to be an ending to a thought, and then there must be a beginning to the next thought. But we typically don't notice that. It's one of these things that goes by too quickly for us, or it's too vague. So that's the issue. Try to look for the beginning of one thought and the ending of one thought and the beginning of the next thought, and see, is there any kind of space? And, you know...
Jack, in relation to what Matteo was saying, in the very process of looking for that gap, or having another thought, I'm sorry, it's very hard to... How do we observe the transition between thoughts without thinking about that transition?
Well, let's see if it's possible. I mean, that seems like a...
That's not incompatible with what has been asked. Because you can have a thought about the gap between other thoughts that you're having.
Right.
I mean, in observing the gap between two thoughts, you're obviously having a thought about the gap.
Well, yeah. Let's do it. Again, we're just going to do it for about 3 minutes. I'm sure that will give us plenty of fodder. Okay. Now.
Three.
Three. Okay, so now you've collected a little data, maybe. Comments, feedback?
Yes, I have been trying to do this a lot of time before. Maybe what I will say is not really what happened now, but maybe from my experience with such kind of exercise. But one thing is that I get nervous because if I want to do this exercise, I have to have thoughts, and then I catch myself trying to produce thoughts so that I can observe them and then see how they fade away. But when a thought actually occurs, then I can only notice it. I don't notice it when it is there, but I notice that it sucked me in. And then at a certain point I notice, okay, that was a thought, and then I'm out of the thought. It's not that I could just step away and see, okay, there is one thought and then it ends and then another thought begins. But when a thought really, really happens, I'm stuck into it. I am that thought. And at a certain point, I realized that I wasn't observing anymore. And that that was the end of the thought. That's my...
Okay. So it's almost like a drowning metaphor, right? And then you come up for air. Yeah. And you're sick.
Yeah.
Okay. Anybody else?
I was very surprised by what I found, which is that the thoughts weren't contiguous at all.
Yes.
There were very large gaps. I mean, it was like kind of the ducks coming by and shooting with spaces between them, which I didn't expect at all. I would have anticipated that they would have run up against each other with very little space between them.
Yes. Okay. I've been thinking from something that somebody said before. You know, are these really examples of the vague? Because I kind of promised you the vague, right? And I was thinking, is that really accurate? And in the I think that might be an interesting example of something that is, in the sense that normally, when we think, we're focused on the content of our thoughts, and what's happening in between thoughts is something very vague for us. Here's a chance to look at it. Yeah. Okay, Russ.
When you introduced this exercise, you said something, if my memory serves, like, well, obviously one thought must stop before the next one can begin. And I thought about telling you right then that my sampling research says that that's not true at all. Many people have multiple thoughts that overlap.
Oh, yes. You're right. And I probably, go ahead.
I declined to do that because I didn't want to get in the way of your exercise.
Okay, thank
you. But then I found in my own thinking, which came as something that was a surprise to me because I actually don't perform my own analysis on my own experience, but I found that there is no gap between the thoughts, between my own thoughts, that it was they seemed to swirl around, and one would come and then another one would come and they would go together for a while, and then that one would leave and the next one would come on, and then that one would swirl around and another one would sort of connect to that, and then that one would disappear.
Basically, it's complete opposite to my discovery.
Right.
And to get back to the armchair introspection, the risk that I have seen repeatedly, and I'm not saying that about you, that writers would observe that kind of thing among their own thoughts and then presume that that's the way it is for everybody, and that's the error of armchair introspection, because people are really quite different from each other in that regard.
Yeah, and people's experience may be very different from one time to another.
Right.
It may not be, but it may be. This is actually a really interesting example, Russ, because I think, you know, I haven't really put those two things together. I agree that, you know, from my own experience sampling with you, that thoughts can be multiple, but I, in doing this exercise, I've always tended to think of them as sequential. But when I think back on my experience just now, there was a multiplicity too. So, you know, that's something for me to explore that comes out of something I learned from sampling with you. Yeah.
For quite a long time, it was quite a long time after you started this, thing, I just wasn't having any thoughts. You know, I was aware, but I was aware of silence, which is a place I like to get into. And then as I sort of, almost like my eyes became accustomed to the dark, I realized there was a bunch of other stuff going on that was not, I guess I have a category of what I really think is thoughts, which is verbalizing and stuff like that. But there were like little visual images floating around and little things kind of like some words back there someplace that were like whispers 50 yards away. And little stuff like that floating around that I wouldn't even have thought to identify as thoughts because they were so big.
Well, maybe it is worth my saying again, because you raised the point, Russ, you know, the point here is not to figure out whether there is a space between thoughts. The point is to have a certain kind of insight into aspects of our experience that are normally not available to us or not, you might say, of interest to us. And they may be very different for different people, and they may be very different for you 10 minutes from now than they are right now.
And that was actually another reason that I didn't say it at the time, because I was giving you credit for possibly giving us an instruction that was a little bit misleading.
There's an exhibit in the Tate Modern in London, which is a series of photographs sort of mounted in sort of frames, but all in a single frame. And that the photographs have been cut up so that actually what you get are bits of a photograph that you normally wouldn't look at, like the space between, you know, someone's foot and then the outline of a building, you know, the side of the building, a bit away with a gap in between. So,
okay.
You know, on the front of Dan Dennett's Sweet Dreams, if I just think of the language, he has a Saul Sternberg cover from New York. Meant to represent the stream of thought. Interestingly enough, there are no gaps in it at all. In fact, in James's account of the stream of thought, he doesn't really mention or allow for gaps, does he?
Yeah.
And so that was why it was a surprise. The rest didn't have it. They were following on from each other, overlapping.
Okay. Well, I thought I'd go back to our friend David for a moment. This is a little long. I don't know if I'll try to go through the whole thing. But again, he did this exercise. While investigating the space between thoughts and their source, at some point thoughtful is a strange word there, but kind of evocative. At some point, thoughtful activity calmed and there was space between. However, a shift in focus revealed that sharing in this space were various forms of sensual input at many different levels. What at first appeared empty turned out to be full. So that sounds a little like Walt, like a sensing ocean with many moving currents and forms. But after a while, this oceanic space expanded and even body sensations thinned out and ceased. That is, most of time's presentations of the multiplicity of seemingly endless levels of form spaced out, and there remained a sense of open, illumined space like a glow, which I might describe as aware spaciousness. After a while, there was a blank, as if I went to sleep, except I didn't fall over, go limp, or nod my head. Later, aware spaciousness reappeared. Because I was intrigued by this blank and the point of emergence, I was drawn out further away as a gathering sense of self. Does that make sense to people? As body feelings and forms returned, including tingling and aches in the legs, and then thoughts. It was interesting to reflect on that whole relinquishing, reacquiring, and establishing moment. I think I'll stop there because we don't have that much time. I'm going to give you my reaction to this, and I'm not sure how valuable it is. This seems to me like a more accurate representation or a more accurate description than what he gave us before.
Yes.
Perhaps because it's more precise, I'm not sure. One reason might be because there are actually some very detailed, precise descriptions of meditative states that are a lot like this, going through exactly that phase. And this is not someone who knew about those, I don't believe, from what I know about his background. So it was interesting to see that he had a similar experience. Any comments on this?
Part of it, though, like Kanto says, I receive from students. There's a phrase, there's sentence, that is, most of times, presentation of the multiplicity of seemingly endless levels of form spaced out. And I think, God, I'd have to read that and reread it, and hope there'd be some sense there.
Okay. Okay, well, I'm going to skip that. Hmm?
If you've processed it. Yeah, we haven't ruined Proust for you.
No, I was just thinking, I just had this with mischievous thought that if it had been, you know, spaced out in a kind of verse form, you might have thought it was, oh, this is quite a nice poem.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. And I thought of Tellensteiner, right? We'll never know.
Okay. We're back to the first question now, and I said for fun that we're condensing and expanding these. I was going to give you a personal anecdote, but I'm not going to because we don't have enough time. So let's go back, or let me go on with this. I think the main point I want to make here is that to the extent that we've been looking at things that are ordinarily vague, that is, are not are in the halo of our ordinary focus of consciousness, what I want to suggest is that the vague is not necessarily the opposite of precise. That is, it's not the same as light and dark. It's possible that you might be able to do something that was both precise and vague in some sense. And the way that I've actually phrased this here is that it's possible, I'm not sure how clear this is, it's possible that you know consciousness in the act of being conscious. I mean, that is kind of my basic take on it. You know consciousness in the act of being conscious. And that act of being conscious cannot be formulated. So to the extent that precision requires that you formulate something, and I'm not saying it necessarily.
Formulate.
Meaning, essentially, put it in, well, make it reflective. Take it from the pre-reflective into the reflective. That's what I mean by formulate. Yeah? To the extent that you think that precision requires that, you may have a vague experience that can't be made precise, but that doesn't mean that the vague experience is the opposite of a precise experience. It's just one on which a certain operation has not been carried out, the formulation operation or the reflection operation. So this is a thought I had just as I was writing this up, really, that you might formulate it this way, that precision, and I think you do get precise descriptions, some of what we've gotten anyway, I think has been quite precise here and in what we were just looking at, that precision has the capacity or has the tendency, let's say, to illuminate the vague. And I underlined the word S there because I think it's something that happens right in the moment. Mm-hmm. There's no other possibility, and that is, it's not going to happen in reflection. If you reflect on what happened to you, you can develop a certain kind of precision. It will be reflective precision. And that will not necessarily illuminate the vague. At that point, the precise and the vague might be opposite. Right? But if you can maintain, or if you can let the precision be there in what would ordinarily be vague, then that vague may be illuminated, which means basically, I think, become more available to consciousness. Okay, this is getting to be a little too much to go through, but let me try to go through some of it. So this goes to the question of, you know, do we want to bracket the presupposed? Is that how we want to find out about consciousness? That is, to the extent we're developing a methodology, do we say, well, I don't want an explanation, I don't want meanings, I don't want stories, I don't want presuppositions, I just want to look at what's actually going on in the experience. And I laid out a few possibilities there. A rigorous exclusion of explanation. and you'll notice that I assigned these to Russ and Claire. I probably got it wrong in some ways, but it seemed like it might be helpful to do that. I notice I didn't put myself in that rigorous exclusion of explanation because I don't care if people give explanations. It's okay with me. I'm not saying that they're the right explanations. I just don't care. If explanation is mixed in with insight, let's say, fine. If they get confused about it, which could happen, people, but usually they don't, at least in this TSK context or in other ways I would have presenting it because I don't just use TSK, they don't usually get confused because one of the points that's so strongly emphasized in this whole approach is that you are not trying to explain things. You're really trying to go to the level of experience. So it hasn't been too much of a problem. Again, a focus on the particular. So these things, I think you understand. I don't need to say much about. Both Russ and Claire emphasize the idea of a very directive interview. I think you've seen a little bit from the way that I've been trying to handle your responses. I'm much less directive. I do try to bring out some of the elements in the experience, and it's interesting to me to see the relationship, but I'm not so directive. Turning from the content is something that I don't think Russ emphasizes as much. I mean, on a certain level, a kind of a base level, kind of the most obvious level, content is exactly what he wants. But Claire has mentioned specifically, if you read her article, she talks a lot about, or she gives an appendix, a long excerpt of an interview she had with someone whom she asked to visualize an elephant. And the interview, you know, the excerpt goes on for pages and pages, and you never do see what the woman, you know, you never find out what the woman visualized. She doesn't care about the content of that visualization. It's more how did the experience arise. And in that, I also, that is very much my concern. And then this idea of dwelling in the vague or dwelling, you know, without worrying too much about what's actually happening or without assuming that you're going to get at the truth in any way. It's the process that I'm interested in. Yeah. And in part that means inviting multiplicity, turning away from content. I asked two questions there. I'm going to skip the first one. The second one is interesting to me in the context of the kind of work that I'm describing, and I'm using David as an example. What I mean by this basically is, here he is, he's been working in something where we're, in an approach in which we're saying, let's look at time differently, in a somewhat Bergsonian way. I wouldn't want to overemphasize that, but there are definitely parallels. And let's look at space in a different way, and let's look at knowledge in a different way. And if you bring that theoretical stance to bear in your experience, if you do an exercise and those ideas are floating around or available to you to say, not just as theories, but maybe as a way of shaping your experience, does that then give you the possibility of experiencing differently? My sense from the work I do is that it does. And that, in fact, that's one of the main purposes of having theories like that. You don't, at least, again, in the work I do, not because the theories are necessarily right, but because they illuminate elements of our experience and challenge assumptions that we make, and therefore make it possible to have different forms of experience, ultimately to the point where even the category experience is open to challenge.
How do you mean that, Jack?
That the category of experience is open? Well, the category of experience is very tied into the idea of someone who's having the experience. Okay. Is armchair introspection a valid approach? I think what I wrote down here is not real sophisticated, but let's go through it quickly. There are some reasons for thinking that it is. What I mean by that first one, a core assumption, is just, I see no reason in principle, and I know Russ has his reasons for not trusting first person or armchair introspection, but in principle it seems to me you want to have a lot of different possible methodologies available to you, and then over time begin to see what works. There's a history of this kind of inquiry, that is the meditative traditions I'm thinking of specifically, and a lot of people who seem to think that it gives you valid knowledge, you know, down in a lot of, in a lot of, yeah, that's right, that's right. There is privileged access. Privileged access is very problematic, but there is something to it, and you can train it. You know, you can, and this is something, you know, Russ sets out to train his subjects. Claire sets out to train her subjects. And in my own really quite different way, I think, I mean, given the approach I'm taking, training is a little bit strong for what I do, but I think, but I mean, just as a word, but I am very much interested in letting people see how they're restricting their own access to experience, to use that word, and giving them ways to challenge those restrictions. Challenging is a big word in TSK. So. And then, you know, to the extent this is true for you, to the extent that you have learned something in any of these exercises, which we did for a very short time, but to the extent that there was something there that surprised you and you think maybe you know something that you didn't know before, or at least have a suggestion that there might be something there that you hadn't thought of before, well, then that gives you a little bit of a personal reason. Maybe you're fooling yourself. It's certainly possible. Reasons for thinking the answer is no. You can't, that is, that you can't do armchair introspection. One is that really ultimately you cannot bracket your presuppositions without, you know, the ones that you operate with because they're so deeply ingrained. But I do think it's possible to train away from that. That's, again, part of what the methodology that I work with is aiming at, precisely. No presuppositions.
You can also become aware of the operation of your presupposition.
Yeah, absolutely.
And under consciousness, and that tends to transform the presupposition itself.
Yes. And you're right, and I didn't. Thank you for clarifying that. I really don't mean to say you can just drop all presuppositions. It's much more a question of becoming aware of a presupposition in operation. And just to take an example from the exercises we did, if you happen to notice some kind of presupposition, one thing you could do with it is expand it or condense it. Just as an example. You know, if you actually have can kind of gain that kind of distance from it, then it's no longer going to cut off your experience in quite the same way. It might still be there. And then if there's no way to direct the mind with precision, this is a point that Claire makes in her work, that we can't focus well enough. Meditative traditions are very big on the idea, especially of the practice we did out here on the porch yesterday for people who were in that, just one second, was in large part about developing a kind of inner calm and stability which does let you focus the mind. So you can make that choice. In the approach that I'm talking about here, you wouldn't necessarily do that, although there's nothing wrong with doing that, and we also work with developing that kind of stability of mind. But even if the mind is not operating in a kind of a calm and relaxed way, there's data to work with in your experience. I know I'm not saying that very clearly, but I'm just going to leave it at that. Russ?
I would add to your list the risk of thinking that everybody is like you, which is one of the major things, so I alluded to that before.
Yeah, you did. But I thought in context, actually, the answer to that was clear because, maybe I shouldn't say that. Suppose somebody goes out and buys the book Time, Space, and Knowledge and goes home and starts working with the exercises and has certain kinds of experiences and then says, this is the way the world is. Then that would be a problem. The kind of context I'm thinking of, which is more kind of in a classroom setting or different people, one of the things you see immediately is that people have incredibly varied experiences.
And I wouldn't refer to that as armchair introspection. That's a different deal.
Okay.
And I also wouldn't put the meditative traditions into armchair introspection.
Okay.
Can you just remind me or us, mm-hmm. You say, is armchair introspection a valid approach mm-hmm. to what?
A valid approach to learning about the nature of consciousness. Is that a way to... your own, first person.
So if for example, this a valid approach to learn about my consciousness?
Yeah, but you do.
Can that be a question?
I mean, sure, because it's always possible to say, just to boil this down even more, that you can never be sure whatever conclusions you arrive at or whatever insight you have or whatever experience you have, that it's not just some story you're telling yourself. Mm-hmm. That could be the counter argument.
If it's just some story that I'm telling myself, then it means that
it hasn't told you anything
about my...
Well, it told you about a certain level of your consciousness, but maybe not a very interesting one. If in fact that's the case. I mean, in my own way of thinking about this, the stories that you use to get clear or to tell yourself what's going on are not very interesting. In that, I think I kind of line up with Russ. There's a lot of things, if you ask someone to talk about their experience, they're going to say a lot of things that are just a reflection of what they believe and don't tell you anything much about what's really going
Jack,
on.
Aren't yes? you presupposing in advance what can be found?
Mm-hmm.
In this exploration of consciousness. I mean, if you in advance say that the stories are not interesting to investigate by themselves,
mm-hmm.
then you are, in my view, presupposing a level mm-hmm. that you know of and somebody doesn't,
mm-hmm.
That this person is inquiring should come to.
Yeah.
If you do that, there is no inquiry anymore.
Well, okay, I take your point, and I think you're right up to a certain point. I actually should have said it differently. Stories are really interesting. Stories are tremendously interesting as stories, as long as you recognize that they're stories. If that's what you're looking, if that's how you're investigating them, in fact, the very fact that we spend most of our conscious experience, this is now my take, I mean, I may be wrong, the very fact that most of the time when we're conscious, we're telling, or at least living out some story, means that that's a tremendously important place to look. But you have to be able first to gain some clarity or insight into the fact that it's a story. Maybe that doesn't completely answer your concern, but that's my take on it.
And I'd like to respond to that too, because there's nothing presuppositional about it on my point of view. I've listened to several thousand stories before I came to that point of view, that the stories aren't very interesting. It wasn't that I started out thinking these stories weren't going to be very interesting.
So deconstructing an armchair and the lotus position.
Well, Russ says that there is, right? Meditation is not armchair. It was a little joke. Little joke. Armchair position and lotus position. Are they different positions?
And, yes.
Why an armchair?
Well, because what I refer to as the armchair position is usually a very undisciplined position, it seems to me. That is something like, well, I've just watched in the privacy of my own armchair, spaces between my thoughts. Therefore, everybody's got spaces in between their thoughts, and James was wrong, and I'm going to spin a philosophical position on that basis. And I think that is not what happens in the lotus position. From the people who are dead meditators, you know,
right.
Just dropping yourself into the lotus position isn't going to be any good. But I was presuming that you were talking about a level of skill there, which generally involves personal, long personal time and also interpersonal time with a master who's helping out.
Yeah. Let me say one thing about the PSK approach and kind of cognate things that I work on. Is that they, in part, they're an answer to the difficulty that in this culture, maybe partly the Western mind, but maybe partly just the kind of lifestyle we lead, it's very difficult to go into deep meditative experience. You can go on retreat, but not many people do that for a long enough time. And this methodology is in part meant to respond to that difficulty by saying, you can do inquiry in a variety of ways, in a variety of contexts. As somebody was saying over here at the beginning of the day, it's at the beginning of the evening, it's not just a question of sitting on your meditation cushion. You can be doing it while you're on the bus or whatever. And I'm not saying that's the most important part about it, but it is, these exercises are meant to be things that you can work with, even if your mind is very agitated, even if you have a lot of emotionality, even if you are prey to all of the difficulties that the Western mind works with. Because it's a really wide range of practices and a lot of opportunities to see things. And so,
I think, Jack, yeah. Let it back up Russ on that. I think it really makes a difference in the kind of experience you have in meditation, what kind of a position you're in, armchair or whatever, it's kind of kicked back, you know. And,
mm-hmm. You're right.
You can easily doze off and you don't doze off. Too easily in a lotus position.
I always say to people in terms when I'm teaching meditation, so now I'm going to step out of this role for a moment, that it's fine to sit in the chair, but armchair sort of has this idea of like this, you know. You want to, you know, if you're going to sit in the chair, sit on the edge of the chair with your feet flat on the ground in as stable a position as you can. And that's not the lotus position, but it's not bad.
It's when they got sitting on this stone as well.
I was just going to ask, well, I imagine that's meant philosophical position with a small p, because Descartes produces a philosophical position from his armchair introspection, which is a very large p, and which was done through a very systematic methodological doubt.
Mm-hmm.
He's wrong for interesting reasons, but it was a very good.
To the extent that armchair introspection means is kind of laid back, and you know, now that I happen to think about it, kind of that quality. You know, I don't think there's anybody around who would defend that too much. Certainly you'd want to be doing something systematic.
There are some quite capital P philosophical positions that hold that there is inner speech that goes on at every moment of the time. And that probably was true for that introspector in his armchair, but it's not true for a lot of people.
I agree, I was referring to Descartes really because his position is very clearly derived from a systematic method of doubting, through doubting his dreams, doubting the physical world, doubting his body and so on. But I don't think that's true of all philosophical positions, so I was just giving one example. So I took you to me.
The real question here for me is, whether one wants to generalize this or not.
You have to stop for just one moment.
That's my question. I mean, if the generalization is the aim, then you're absolutely right. Because there is a danger that I might find something in myself and then uncritically
some analytic truths you thought, it wasn't any question whether they could have just local to himself. He thought these, you know, logically, he's come to conclusions which couldn't be contrary and contradicting. I don't think in Descartes' case, the conclusions he came to were very largely analytic ones. I mean, that he, you know,
and
this
they were
one,
universal.
Yeah, it has to be universal.
In Claire's research, generalization is the aim.
Would you say, Claire?
Not really a generalization. Because a generic structure as variants, it's not a real stronger generalization.
But you're developing models of underlying mental structures which generalize from person to person.
No, I was saying that the generic the act of becoming aware has a generic structure. It's an hypothesis. And if it's this could be a very good basis in my opinion for a science of consciousness. If the act of becoming aware of our experience and describing it as a generic structure.
To go back to Descartes, the cogito is not meant to just be a local result, which you know, might be true of me, which wouldn't be true of anyone else. It was meant to be a metaphysical pronouncement, I mean, about where you get to and have to stop.
And it's really
so Russell's argument that Descartes sitting on his stove was just making some interesting observation about the case of René Descartes certainly wasn't what he even thought he was doing.
But it wasn't really first person research, was it? It was logical working out.
I'm not being critical of Descartes here, but I think this becomes actually a broader phenomenon in the sense that you have all kinds of people who feel that they have become enlightened or have understood something that is of universal value, that there are two fundamental questions. One is, do they even really understand how they came to that understanding? And the other is, the way they came to that understanding really applicable to, let's say, somebody who has a very different psychological disposition? And yet, people are going around all over trying to teach a method that brought them, or a method that they believe is the method that brought them to some understanding that they now feel is of universal value, and yet they become very ineffective often at finding that they can actually transmit or that same understanding.
I
thought you were doing something very like that and saying what we should aim for is this stability between these alternative, contradictory positions. And it was very much like Nietzsche's contemplative conclusion that, the principle of eternal return was incontrovertibly, a position which we had to be valued as a sort of place where you end up. And I think that we can identify some arguments which actually work universally and which people have come to.
Well, I believe
that's true too, but I also have witnessed over and over again that the methodologies become very complicated when you start to apply them beyond yourself.
Well, I think
you may be able to state a conclusion, like Buddha may state a conclusion that life is sorrow, okay, or whatever we think the interpreter. Now, I may read that as a conceptual statement about the nature of life. And sorrow may mean something to me that is analytical, let's say. But somebody else is a much more feeling.
Okay, wait. I want to stop this. Russ had his hand up. The reason I want to stop it is just because it's very late. It's 10:10, and I think I want to take about 2 minutes to finish up. But since Russ had his rounding, Russ and Claire, I feel like I have to give you your due. So anything you want to say.
I would like to say that I don't mean to say that it is impossible to do good work in the armchair. What I would like to say is that many people who do work in the armchair are unjustifiably confident in their work. And that's not just a generalization problem, it's a self-characterization problem.
Okay.
And therefore, I would say, probably not a good thing on which to base a science of consciousness, because it isn't going to be interpersonally, whatever y'all called it this afternoon, interpersonally, the modernly, whatever it was. It's going to be tough, because people are far too highly confident in their own armchair observation.
Clear?
Yes, for me, the very interesting thing to do would be to compare the way each of these methods, something we're still unaware, comes to our consciousness. Each method has its own process, its own, and it would be interesting to compare. And for me,
it's
that's all.
Okay. Well, let me say just maybe one thing about general structures. You know, I have my own kind of general structures that I've written about that I find helpful as a way of looking at experience, but I do very much have a sense that that's all they are, you know, that they're helpful, what's the word I want? They're heuristic devices, I suppose I could say. They're ways to get you to look at your experience in a certain way, and I think it was Steve mentioned something earlier today when we were talking about this question of, it was Matei's question, you know, is there cumulative knowledge? And I do think that, you know, if you don't have a way to look at experience, which usually comes to you conceptually, it's very difficult never to get off the ground even. I think you really usually want to start from some sort of a conceptual structure. But you also want to be able to leave that behind if that becomes the right thing to do, or if you feel that you have, if that's justified in your own experience. I won't try to say any more about armchairs. I'll just take us back to William James to close. This is also just a nice quote. I actually found it by accident. I was looking for something else. But he said, thought deals solely with surfaces. It can name the thickness of reality, but it cannot fathom it. And I guess, although I hadn't realized this until I just read that out loud, that's what I was just trying to say. That it's very important to be able to name the thickness of reality. That's really useful, if you can do that. You know, Descartes had a few valuable things to say about that. But it cannot fathom it. The only way in which to apprehend reality's thickness is either to experience it directly by being a part of reality oneself, which is a wonderful notion, or to evoke it in imagination by sympathetically divining somewhere else's inner life. Now, I don't know what to do with that last one in terms of my own interests, but there are other people in this room who I think would find that a very interesting research program as well.
I hardly dare read James, because every time I want to quit something, I find I actually want to quit the paragraph immediately before it, and the paragraph. It's just so interesting.
Yeah. Okay, so I think I'll stop there. I have a little more that I'm just going to skip, but I would say keep things open. You know, keep experience open. That's my final. That's my advice. Okay, thank you. So tomorrow morning, breakfast is at the usual time, I believe. And then my thought was that if we meet in the main parking lot at 9 o'clock, does that sound okay to people?
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to need four cars. Well, how many people are going to want to come down? Let me point out to you that it's a fairly steep walk, you know, the walk back up. You should be aware of that. It's not terrible, and the trail is fine. It's not, you know, but it's fairly steep. You might be kind of winded by the time you get back up to the top. So, with that warning, how many people are planning on coming? Okay, let's see. Is anybody who's not? You're not? Possibly. Okay, so that's everybody. No? Not you? Okay, so we're at 3, 6, 9, 12, 14. Is there anybody who's not here? No. Okay. So it's 14 people. Well, we still need 15. So we still need four cars.
You were bracketing yourself, weren't you?
That was what?
You were bracketing yourself.
I was bracketing myself, yes. That's in my role. Okay. Well, we have five cars as far as I know. So somebody doesn't need to drive. I think I'd better drive because I know where we're going. So we need three more cars. The first three hands up. One, two, three. Okay.
So where are we driving to?
It's not far. It's about 3 miles. We're going to drive up to, we can talk about this tomorrow, but Cruz Reyes Road is about a mile from here, a little less, back that direction. And then we're going to head down Cruz Ranch. And I will go down early tomorrow to scope it out, because I'm not, the one thing I'm a little concerned about is there, can you pull off the road and park? It's a very narrow, not fully paved road. It's a little country road, you know. But I will have checked that out by 9 o'clock.
So what do we get to the bottom of?
Ah, okay. So it's about an hour and a half, let's say about a mile and a half walk, as I remember. At the end of it, you get to Highway 1, which is not so exciting. And then you cross over... and then you cross over Highway 1, and take a little trail down to the beach, which is actually quite a nice beach. It's small, but it's very nice. It's got a nice cliff on one side. It's a very typical Northern California beach.
There's a sea to go to swim.
Yeah. If you really are intent on saying, you know, on dipping your foot in the Pacific Ocean, you can do so. But
also, we stopped at one of those beaches, and by the restroom, there was this huge sign that said, "Danger. This is one of the most dangerous beaches on Earth."
Okay. So 9 o'clock. So my rough sense, I mean, I've only done this trail a couple of times, so I don't remember it too well, but my rough sense is that, you know, it takes over an hour each way. And so if we leave at 9, and that leaves us, you know, maybe an hour down at the beach, I think is enough. And then we'll be back in time for lunch. And I did ask Janet if they could get us some water. That's the only thing that I think, you know, we probably want to make sure to have with us. But there's issues like sun hats, and it's a shady trail. But the beach is, of course, the beach. So you could get, I don't know, it's a little early in the year to get really sunburned, but you might like to take a hat. And if people have some kind of bag to stick a, you know, the weather, it's possible, I don't think it's likely given the weather we've had, but it's possible that when we get to the beach it will be foggy and 10 degrees colder than it is here. So you might just take some extra sweater or something. And of course, good walking shoes.
Good walking feet.
Good walking feet, yes. Wiggle the feet inside the shoes. Okay.
Excuse me, Jack. How would you modify this schedule for your within the trip and just
begin
the
rest of
the day?
You're
subbing
somebody.
Yeah, that's
the time. No, we have made it. Is it on the...
No, it's on the...